want the Republicans to wake up is what the Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to do it live!
Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Thanks for downloading the latest in-depth interview podcast from peterbcollins.com. This week we observe Veterans Day here in the United States. I've got a doubleheader for you. First up, we have a retired admiral who served more than 30 years in the Navy, Joe Sestak. And once again, he's running for the Senate in the state of Pennsylvania. He lost narrowly by about 2 percentage points 5 years ago. And he has strong statements in support of veterans, and he responds to my questions about the mess in Syria and Congress's failure to do its duty on war powers legislation for the current conflicts. And in our second segment, you're going to meet former Staff Sergeant Stanford Mendenhall. He is 100% disabled as a result of serving in the Army National Guard, where he was deployed to Ground Zero after 9/11, and then at least one tour of duty in Iraq, where he was exposed to depleted uranium residue. And you'll hear his very honest characterizations of how the military and the Veterans Administration force our veterans to fight a new war to get the health care services that they deserve. Before we hear from our guests today, I want to thank the people who support my work with your subscriptions to the Peter B. Collins podcast. Folks like Annette McManus, Susan Gavet, Jeff Zeiser, and Carl Howard way out there in Columbus, Ohio. I appreciate each and every one of you. Invite those who never hear your names mentioned here to join in. Come on over to peterbcollins.com. On the home page, click the menu button. And then next, you can choose Become a Subscriber. On that page, it's laid out for you. $5, $10, $20 a month or $50 annual subscription. Or you can make a one-time contribution of any amount using PayPal or the U.S. mail. However you decide to support me, I thank you in advance. As we observe Veterans Day across America, there have been parades, salutes, flags are flying. But what about the veterans themselves? We've got to pay more than just lip service to the men and women who have served our country. And I believe we have to honor their service by taking care of them, especially those who have been wounded in the line of duty. Joe Sestak was one of the highest-ranking military men to serve in the United States Congress. He retired at the rank of admiral after serving in the U.S. Navy for more than 30 years. He served 2 terms in Congress from Pennsylvania and traded up to run for the U.S. Senate 5 years ago. And he succeeded in the primary, defeating Arlen Specter, who had just become an instant Democrat in a deal with the White House where Joe didn't enjoy the support of the party establishment. He defeated Specter and went on to lose to Republican Pat Toomey in a real squeaker, just a 2% spread there. And he is now, he's not quite running to challenge Toomey. He is walking on a daily basis across the Keystone State. Joe Sestak, always a pleasure to talk with you.
Peter, it's great to be back. Thank you.
And first up, tell our listeners about how you plan to unseat Pat Toomey. And you've been walking hundreds of miles across the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania.
I intend to do exactly, Peter, what I did in 2010. When we came within 2 points in that year of anger, the year of the Tea Party, and yet we were outfunded 3-1, the largest funding gap of any Senate race in America, I intend to walk in the shoes of Pennsylvanians. Pennsylvanians, like Americans across this nation, believe that the biggest deficit we have in America isn't the national debt, it's the trust deficit. Who can they trust? Who's willing to be accountable for them for when it goes wrong as well as right? That's what they're looking for. And so that's why I did the walk, the 422 miles across Pennsylvania, through snow, through rain. And every day I did an event in the shoes of a different group of Pennsylvanians, from seniors, where we have had an increase in Pennsylvania of 35% in elder abuse, almost on an annual basis, to women who still today can't get paycheck fairness in making sure that equal work for equal pay for equal work. That's why I go to the people above anything else, and that will prevail. I have no doubt about it.
Well, for decades, Joe, we have not honored the trust of those who have served, particularly in combat. And I'm really touched that as part of your effort to recognize veterans this year, you're going to go into a prison and visit with veterans there. And you know, we're aware of those who are homeless and live under the freeway, but those who have gone to prison have largely been written off, and in many cases they don't have family, they don't have any social network to connect to. And Joe, you know, certainly there's campaign value in this, but I know you well enough that this is more than a gesture. This is something where you really see people who need to be connected with.
Peter, I've done this every year for a decade, that on Veterans Day when I was a congressman, I would just quietly go to a prison and visit veterans every year. Usually I also did it on Armed Forces Day, but when I didn't win that final race in 2010, I continued to go back in 2011, 12, 13, every year, because I didn't want to thank the veterans. Just because I wasn't a congressman, I wasn't going to be there. I get about a letter every week, week and a half, from someone in prison who's a veteran. And I just want them to know that and remind them that at a moment in your life, we were so proud of you. We are still proud of you today. If in the case of that some of you, when you came home, like from Vietnam, we hadn't ignored you, neglected you. We didn't know what PTSD was back then. There were two recessions. And like the head of the Greater Ford Penitentiary I will go and visit, he came back from Vietnam, committed a crime. He got no job. He had no job, PTSD, involved in drugs, and soon that crime landed him in the penitentiary. Perhaps he wouldn't be there, strong probability wouldn't, if we, the government, a government of, for, and by the people, had addressed his PTSD when we needed to. That's why I go back, to remind them that we were all brethren together at one time serving our country. No prouder moment did we all have.
Mm-hmm. And Joe, you know, as I look at the broken promises to veterans, up to and including the problems at the VA today, I feel that just like when we buy a six-pack of beer and you pay the deposit for those bottles in advance, that when we sign up for a new war, a new military adventure, that we have to build in the cost of caring for our veterans, both those who are wounded physically, who need you know, direct medical care, and those who suffer psychologically. And, you know, we continue to avoid that process and then try to backfill the needs of veterans largely as an afterthought. And even though I never served in the military, Joe, I find that deeply offensive to those who have.
What you have just said has lent itself to a large reason why Pennsylvanians, where almost every family appears to have someone who was involved in the military, has lost trust in our government, our public officials. I mean, let me give you just one example, if I might.
Mm-hmm.
We have a senator who, when he was congressman, Pat Toomey, he actually voted to send me and all my fellow veterans to war. He visited my aircraft carrier as we were bombing away in Iraq. He came home, and he has voted against every single Veterans Administration budget every year, 12 times until this past December, against standalone bills for the post-traumatic stress disorder of our veterans. And yet, we have spent hard cash, $1 trillion. Another $2 trillion is expected to be spent over the next few decades trying to take care, as society, of the human damage that was done as our troops came home. And so my take is that, yeah, let's have public officials who remember that the cost and the greatest cost of going to war is our service members and their families. Take care of them. They are part of the cost of war because they give us the benefit of our security by doing so.
And Joe, one of the many concerns I have is that so many of our troops were exposed to depleted uranium munitions that were used, particularly in the early going on the ground in Iraq. And I'm curious what you know about how the VA has responded, and if we have, on parallel to the Agent Orange injuries from Vietnam, acknowledged severe risk and long-term damage that we have exposed many Iraq War veterans to.
I was involved a bit in the studies, looking at them, not only there, but also in the former Yugoslavia. Because studies have been done not just by the United States on trying to determine the impact, but also those by other governments have looked at it. And although there was, as I was leaving government, no final firm conclusion, and I also actually operated on a Navy ship with depleted uranium out of a system called CWIS, and I wanted to know because of my own troops. My point is that I don't know the final outcome of that, but I do know this. We were too long to coming to addressing Agent Orange and accepting that, again, the cost that was in part of Vietnam was our use of Agent Orange. And so, Lord willing, I'm a senator. I intend to actually continue to look into this when I'm down there because I am still working today with a veteran of trying to get Agent Orange be recognized as impacting Blue Water Navy sailors who often had to suck up into their water intake waters off the coast of Vietnam with Agent Orange within it.
Mm-hmm.
And I intend to pursue that also again when I get down there because the bill has languished down there.
Joe, one of the issues that really concerns me these days is that the Republican-controlled Congress has outright failed, ignored its obligation to debate and assign its idea of war powers, a framework, to the current conflict in Iraq and Syria. And I'm not in favor of this conflict. I'll just be very clear with you about that. But there's this fundamental constitutional duty. And the Congress has taken side trips into, Benghazi, 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 attacks on Planned Parenthood. They will, fork over money that the president and the Pentagon didn't ask for the wars in the Middle East, but they will not take a position and enumerate what the president should or should not do in this current conflict. And it not only creates this vacuum of power, but it also forces the president to extend presidential authority in ways that I'm extremely uncomfortable with, considering that we could have a president named Trump.
I have worked in the White House as Director of Defense Policy of the National Security Council and watched closely because as the president made decisions to use force within the War Powers Act being a part of the law. I've also served in Congress and watched the abdication of any type of resolute involvement in the shared responsibility for hostilities and war and conflict that the Congress has permitted to happen. 4 years I was on the Armed Services Committee, and yet they never brought forward a discussion on Iraq and whether that's what we were doing, whether we're doing was correct. So I agree with you on the premise and the principle that Congress, who has provided in the Constitution the right to declare war and also provide for the rules and regulations of war and can terminate war through appropriations, for example, has not set forward as a united force, a voice in order to address it. But that's the downside of the system, because we have become divisive down there rather than disagreeable and then come together in a voice. On the other hand, I have in the White House seen that the president has the right in limited, very narrow scope and in the means of warfare to act. And this is a constitutional issue that the Supreme Court has stepped out of. But I will say this, while I may be supportive and have been of what the presidents have done since 1973 and that act having been and the resolution being passed, I strongly feel that Congress has absolutely sidestepped any type of involvement to help determine the right decision in doing so. And you can see that in Syria today, where all you get is critique. You never get a vote.
No, we have silenced Democrats, those who would oppose this war if a Republican was in the White House, and we have the snipers from the right who simply take pot shots at the president and they have no risk in the criticisms they offer because they just talk nonsense, about bombing Iran, about widening the war in Syria, when there really is no resolution that we can see on the horizon. And, you know, we're talking about creating a new Libya, bordering Israel, bordering Iraq, bordering Turkey. And it's really just incoherent, and yet we see the Congress is content to operate in this manner, Joe.
Well, this is an issue that I feel very so strongly about, that when I was asked to run by the for the governor of Pennsylvania, I demurred. And because I felt, well, I just lost a Senate race. That doesn't mean I'm automatically qualified to run for governor. But I also did it because it's a dangerous world out there. And I thought my experience I could bring to the Senate, because that Senate is devoid on the Republican side of understanding of the nexus of foreign policy and military policy. Imagine 47 Republican senators, including Senator Pat Toomey, who wrote a letter to the Ayatollah of Iran and said, let's work in a bipartisan way against our president, who's negotiating the Iranian Accord. And then on the Democratic side, where was the titan that could stand up of old and shape the debate on this agreement or shape it on what to be done in Syria? I would like to bring those years of experience where I came to understand militaries might be able to stop a problem, but we can't fix a problem. Does anybody think our military fixed Iraq?
I'll let that question linger, Joe, because as I look at the situation in Syria and Iraq today, it has become, pardon my language, a clusterfuck. And the idea that we can engineer both the removal of Assad and the degradation or, removal, whatever we want to call the extermination of the Islamic State, is really far-fetched. And the New York Times recently caught up with me, pardon me, and described the president's approach as incoherent and hallucinatory. And that was before Russia started bombing. And we've seen Turkey, a nominal ally, operate with its own agenda. Over the weekend, the New York Times report that the facade of a coalition has crumbled, that Saudi Arabia and the Emirates are no longer actively participating alongside the United States. And we know that after a year of almost daily air raids, there has been little change on the ground, and the Islamic State appears to be pretty much where it was a year ago.
Peter, I happen to agree, not just on this show, but for 3 years now, even maybe close to three and a half, that our approach to this issue has not been correct, coherent, strategic. In fact, even today, I strongly believe that when we look at ISIS, we can no longer look at it as just a terrorist threat. This is a wannabe, extraordinarily dangerous, aspiring nation wannabe. It really does have millions of dollars setting up its own laws, wall swaths of areas that it's actually controlling. And so the right approach to this is not just as a terrorist organization, because it's as a, how can we get other nations like Russia, Iran, those nations that see this ISIS as illegitimate, as dangerous. It's a balance of power approach, and that's diplomacy. That isn't boots on the ground for us. And in my mind, the failure to recognize it strategically as something where, you know, maybe we can bring a cohort together under our leadership to properly address this issue rather than kind of go it alone or saying, well, 50 special forces might solve the problem. Well, within which strategic plan are you saying that this will help us solve the problem? My mind is that today they truly need to look at this differently, because left alone, that can eventually become truly a danger to Israel and us. But it doesn't take our boots on the ground to bring a coalition under our guidance together to where those nations there are the ones that handle the problem, including Russia.
And Joe, as we wrap up, because I know your time is limited today, we talked a little while ago about the legacy of Vietnam and the veterans who continue to pay a price for our involvement there. And I really believe that this recent deployment of the 50 special forces is really just, the first of what will be, I think, a year from now, seen as a dramatic escalation. And I'm very concerned that the American people are so passive about this. You know, I can criticize the president, and I do. I can criticize the Republican-controlled Congress, and I do frequently. But we also have to look at the public. Everybody knows what's going on, and they're more interested in, you know, handicapping Carson versus Trump in a popularity contest than they are really looking at the very serious issues that confront our country.
I have strongly believed for 2 to 3 years now that national security issues abroad will rise more and more to the fore of impacting our security, our prosperity here at home. I'm including on the other side of the world from the Middle East what's happening in South China Sea.
Mm-hmm.
And so my take on it is you hit it spot on, even with the example of these 50 troops, who down there in the Senate or in the administration is properly addressing the use of, let's say, 50 soldiers by saying, here's what has to be done. Here's the metrics by which you can measure our progress. And if those metrics are or are not being met, we then have an exit strategy. That means we've closed it down properly, having told the public in a transparent way, this is why we can tell you with a surety 50 will or won't do the job, and then exit with success, or having been able to measure it, not permit an undue escalation happen because there was misjudgment. That lack of laying out the cost and the benefits, milestones within a strategy, because how can you develop a strategy for Syria unless you know what the milestones are for achieving it? And so your issue here is one where I feel too few. Like when I happened to learn so much about it as the Director of Defense Policy and how did it help develop the annual national security strategy we had, where we laid out how to lay out a strategy for the use of force. And I think that's absent today too much, certainly by those in the U.S. Senate.
Yeah. Well, Joe, it's always a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you for, you could be comfortably retired, a snowbird in Florida as things get cold there in Pennsylvania. But you're staying to really fight to get into the United States Senate. And I truly respect that, and I wish you all the best.
Peter, thank you. But again, although I served 31 years in the United States Navy and loved it, in war as well as in the White House and defense policy, I owe this country. Because when my then 14-year-old daughter got brain cancer, and this nation provided me the health care within the military, that today she's 14, I got into Congress for one reason, 2006, with the belief that national security begins at home, in health, and then education security. This is a payback tour to my country for giving me the opportunity for my daughter to be all she can be.
You mean your dad didn't loan you $1 million when you got out of college?
My father, the greatest man I ever met, is the epitome of the American dream. Came here from Czechoslovakia, raised 8 kids, my mom a high school math teacher, and I have never met anyone who's better epitomizes that what he gave us was an understanding that you can't do better for yourself than by serving others above yourself.
Thank you, Joe.
Thank you, Peter.
Always a pleasure. Joe Sestak, running for the United States Senate in Pennsylvania.
On gets tough. The tough get going, 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 going.
As America observes Veterans Day, I received an email from a veteran who said he'd like to talk with you. And so, without any further ado, I introduce Stanford Mendenhall. He retired or left the military as a staff sergeant after serving our country, first in the New York Army National Guard, where he pulled duty at Ground Zero after 9/11. And then in 2005, he was deployed to Iraq, where he told me he served in the Green Zone and Taji. Sergeant, thanks for being with me today.
You're welcome.
Well, it's good to talk with you. And there are a few things I wanted to let you know. In the preceding segment of this podcast, I interviewed Joe Sestak. He is a retired admiral who served 2 terms in Congress. He is running for the United States Senate in Pennsylvania. And he had some interesting things to say about veterans and about, in particular, health care for veterans of the war in Iraq. And I specifically asked him about depleted uranium, because one of the things that you told me in your email is that you were exposed to DU, and you wanted to counsel other veterans to sign up for the DU registry. First of all, tell me about your experiences. Were you firing DU munitions, or were you in an area where they were being used?
No, we were Baghdad. It was polluted with everything over there in Taji also. So you don't necessarily have to be firing them, but explosives like, car bombs and everything like that. And that's what they do. They coat it. They coated the vehicles and everything, the armored vehicles, with this stuff to protect the vehicles. And one of the soldiers that I was in charge of, he came back, positive, and he was riding in my vehicle pretty much every day.
Mm-hmm. So, now, this is interesting because I have, studied the use of depleted uranium. And, as I understand it, it's primarily used to coat the tips of bullets or shells, bombs, and it cuts through metal like a hot knife through butter. I didn't know that DU was used in a defensive manner to, as you described it, up-armor the vehicles. Tell me about that.
Right. Used to penetrate the vehicles, but the vehicles are used to, to protect the soldiers also. Mm-hmm. With this stuff. And what happened, we found out later, I think it was in Texas, when they brought a lot of the vehicles back from Iraq, a lot of the civilians that had to clean these vehicles ended up with cancer, forms of cancer and everything. Mm-hmm. It was I can't remember where in Texas where these vehicles was stored at. But, mm-hmm. That's what actually happened with them. And like right now, I ended up with a compression fracture in the T9, and with osteoporosis, and they don't know why and how it happened. Mm-hmm. It's just that, all my blood work comes back normal, but everything else is pretty much falling apart.
So your body has been severely damaged by your military service. Is that fair to say?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Now, in speaking with retired Admiral Sestak, he told me that while he was in Congress, and he left 5 years ago, that he served on the Armed Services Committee in the House, and that he was pursuing studies and investigations of depleted uranium. He also said that in the 1990s, when he commanded a warship off the coast of Yugoslavia, that we were using depleted uranium in that conflict as well. So he does share concerns about it, and he still seems frustrated that the military, so long after the fact, has not reached any conclusion. And we compared it in my conversation with him to Agent Orange, which the military stonewalled on for, almost 20 years.
Before they want the veterans to pass away, and then they won't have to pay the benefits.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's why they stonewall the veterans.
Now, in your email, Sergeant, you told me about a DU registry at the Veterans Administration. Share that with our listeners.
Yes, I got on the registry where you have to you have to do a urinalysis for like a week in a bottle, and then they send it off. And they just told me I didn't have enough in my system to, you know, confirm that I was exposed enough. But, you know, that's what they say, but you never can tell. But what the strangest thing about it, when I was in New York, I did the same study, but what they did was, the strangest thing, they sent me the bottle with my first name being Patrick Mendenhall.
Hmm.
And ever since that, for some strange reason, even with my phone called now, people ask me, well, it's showing up, Patrick Mendenhall. And I said, no, my name is Stanford. I said, you know what? Ever since the military sent me the container in New York with Patrick Mendenhall on it, a lot of things, emails or whatever I send sometime, it'll come up Patrick Mendenhall.
Well, let's put out an all-points bulletin here, Sergeant. If you know Patrick Mendenhall, or Patrick, if you happen to be listening, email Peter at peterbcollins.com, and let's see if you have been switched out for Stanford Mendenhall, because I'd certainly love to get to the bottom of this.
Ever since that happened, my phone calls, sometimes I show up and people say, well, why is it showing up Patrick?
Huh.
I have no clue.
That is really strange.
Emails, or sometimes my emails will come up as Patrick. And people say, well, it's showing Patrick Mendenhall. You know, ever since I tried to get on this DU registry in New York, my name been changed to Patrick.
Well, just to let you know, I got three or four emails from you, and they don't call you Patrick. It's either Mendenhall's or Stanford Mendenhall. So at least for me, they're not trying to mix you up with somebody else. But
right.
let's put aside what the military says. What does your own body tell you about the impact of your military experience? And also, you were exposed at Ground Zero. You described to me that your lungs were affected by whether it was asbestos or similar materials that you inhaled while you were on duty there. What does your body tell you? It sounds to me like your body is losing function and trying to shut down in some ways.
I stayed in the hospital in New York for like 9 days, and my lungs was dealing with fluid, and I went into a congestive heart failure. They don't know why, and it was a major problem that I was having. And then they said that my lungs had like some type of glass or something. Look in there, you know. So mm-hmm. It's been a major problem with me.
Yeah.
And the doctors can't figure out why my T9 collapsed, because they thought I was near an explosion, a huge explosion. I said, no. Did you get hit? No. Did you fall? No. They said, well, that's not normal for that T9 to collapse like that.
Mm-hmm.
So,
now, what has the military and the VA done to help you with your medical problems, Sergeant?
Now I'm unemployable, so I get all the care there. But I had a problem with Northport VA in New York, where they claimed that, you know, that there was no fracture there in that T9, and I kept going and going for over a year, and they kept saying, no, there's nothing there. So I went to a private doctor, and within 2 or 3 days, I got a phone call, telling me that, you know, you have a compression fracture.
Mm-hmm.
So then the VA tried to cover it up, because we went to federal court to sue them for negligence.
Mm-hmm.
And the VA tried to say, I went to them on a Monday, and they said that there was nothing wrong. So that Wednesday or Thursday of the same week, I went to the private doctor. They got the information, and they said, no, you have a compression fracture. And then the VA tried to argue from that Monday to that Wednesday or whenever I went to the civilian, that's when I fractured my back.
I see. Yeah, it was your fault. Uh-huh.
Right, and I had been complaining even in Iraq when I came home on my 2 weeks leave in February of 2005. I told them, I said, I have chest pains, but I'm hurting in the back area here, and that's exactly where that fracture
mm-hmm.
was, in the back area. But, you know, we had to go to federal court, and we sued, and we won.
Mm-hmm.
They tried to invoke the Paris Act, but, you know, there was the lawyer that I had out in New York was really good, and we got around the Paris Act.
Mm-hmm. So what is your status now? Do you get a disability check, and do you have access
yes.
to health care at the VA?
Yes. Yes. Mm-hmm. I'm 80/unemployable.
Mm-hmm.
So that means I can't work.
Right. And do you believe that your country has properly honored you for your service and given you the resources that you need to recover from what happened to you in uniform?
I know, because everything you get from them, you have to fight and appeal and appeal. And that's all, you know, that happened to you. You know, it took me and my wife over 4 years fighting and appealing. It's like I have serious now sinus problems, in which I was getting sinus infections in Iraq. And when I filed the claim, they tried to say in the report that I had said that I had sinus problems before I went in. But then when I appealed it to the judge at the Veterans Affairs in Washington, D.C., she went through my entire file, and she was so upset and with the regional office in Montgomery and told them, you guys need to fix it, because I went through the entire file, and there was nothing in his file that he ever said that he had these problems.
Mm-hmm.
And then they never confirmed that I had sinus surgery at the Birmingham VA.
That's in Alabama.
That wasn't even in my record, and
mm-hmm.
that's what upset the judge, too. It was like, he said he had a surgery at the Birmingham VA on his sinus. Where's that record?
Mm-hmm.
So...
Now, Sergeant, what you've just described, I think, is interesting and quite ironic, because you're probably aware that one of the big accomplishments of the Obamacare legislation is it removed the cause called pre-existing conditions from permitting an insurance company to deny you coverage. All right? So
right.
The law of the land now is that you cannot deny somebody coverage for pre-existing conditions. Yet when you brought your combat injuries and your exposure at Ground Zero to the attention of the appropriate, you know, medical servicers, what they told you was, go away, this must be a pre-existing condition or something that occurred outside of military service.
Yes, that's exactly what they was trying to argue.
That's pretty insulting to a man who put his life on the line.
It is, and you know, they really don't care. They don't really care. You find some good people at the VA, but those good people are silent. You know, if they say anything, they probably lose their job.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, Sergeant, it may sound gratuitous, but this is sincere. I really appreciate your service. And I, for one, am really embarrassed that my government sent you into danger and is fighting back when you try to access the health care that you richly deserve. And I want to ask you to, you know, talk as long as you'd like here, but what would you like to say to my listeners about the way you have been treated?
Well, I just think if there are any other veterans out there that's really listening, they just need to keep filing their appeals and keep filing their appeals. And sometime when they go and try to get these organizations that are out there that's supposed to help, they get offended. You know, it's like, well, you're getting 100%, so what else do you want? I said, well, I want this in my record, that this is actually an issue that occurred while I was on active duty.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and that's what really upset you. As a matter of fact, even when I was trying to argue this issue about my finances, I got a phone call from the region office, like, threatening me, like, if you keep appealing us, we're going to take some of the money that we're giving you. So I was like, go right ahead. I'm still going to appeal this. So
mm-hmm.
You have to keep fighting. And that's the only thing, because that's what I keep telling people. The problem is that a lot of soldiers just give up. Say, you know what, I'm not going to even appeal it again. I said, that's what they want, you know.
Right.
If they can get one or two soldiers to stop fighting them, then, you know, that's money for their bonuses.
Well, and it's kind of cold, but you said it a little earlier. When I referenced, you know, any kind of treatment for depleted uranium, he said, well, they just want the soldiers to die before they acknowledge that they created this very serious health condition among people who served in active duty.
Because what they did was they didn't, you know, they just thought that we can go into Iraq and out of there within a couple of months.
Right.
They didn't calculate the cost for the injuries and the amount of death that, you know, that they, the money that they would have to pay out to the family. So that's why they had to, you know, fight the soldiers to keep them giving them what they deserve.
Mm-hmm.
Because they didn't calculate that, you know, in the court.
Well, and that's a point I made to Joe Sestak, Sergeant, and that is that when the Congress authorizes military action, I believe they should have to start putting aside money from day one to pay for the health care costs, both for physical and psychological injuries that are quite predictable when you send our troops into combat.
Yeah, and you know, what's really sad is that they waste so much money. It's unbelievable the amount of money that, you know, that they, it was like an issue where the M1 tanks, they had put aside millions and millions of dollars for the M1 tank to upgrade.
Mm-hmm.
But the commanders were saying, you know, this is a waste of money. These tanks are working properly. No, you have to spend this money on the upgrade. So, you know, that's a waste of money. Then you have, like, where my wife, because we got transferred down here, because of the AW2 program, because my wife, there was a program out there. If the soldier can't work, they would, you know, they would get the spouse a job.
Mm-hmm.
But when she got down here, she seen how political everything is. Where she's in a contract attorney, where she was trying to get the soldiers the correct equipment to be able to fight the war, but she was getting, you know, pushed back on from her supervisors, and then she discovered it was major, they were signing off on contracts that they shouldn't be signing off on. It was major contract fraud.
Hmm.
And then they went after her to cover it up.
Yeah.
So, you know, if they would stop wasting so much money, you know, there would be enough money there for the soldiers.
Right. Well, Sergeant, I appreciate you reaching out and sharing your story. And is there anything else you'd like to say as we observe Veterans Day 2015?
No, I'd just like to say, you know, happy Veterans Day to all the veterans out there. And let's keep the faith and keep fighting.
Staff Sergeant Stanford Mendenhall, not to be confused with a guy named Patrick Mendenhall.
Right. Thank you so much, sir.
Thanks for being with me. And here on Veterans Day, happy trails to all of the people who have served in uniform.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails.